In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle on News Talk 760 WJR, presented by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Here's Marie Osborne and Rochelle Riley.
Another Sunday afternoon and another In the Mix. We're so thrilled you could join us today. Rochelle Riley is off this week, but that doesn't mean that we don't have a show that's packed with some interesting guests. Coming up a little bit later on in the show, we're going to be talking about the Miss America pageant. Believe it or not, there's going to be a new judge on the Miss America pageant this year, and it is a former Miss America who left in 1984, had to give up her crown in disgrace. Vanessa Williams, she's back. We'll be talking about that later on the show. But first up, how about a new career? How about graduating debt-free? Boilermakers, carpenters, cement masons, bricklayers, all those jobs are looking for people. Joining us next on In the Mix is Patrick Devlin. Patrick, why don't you first tell us a little bit about what is MUST? What does it stand for?
MUST stands for Management and Union Striving Together. And it's a collaborative effort to make our projects more safe. We conduct our safety, our alcohol and drug training program, one of the best in the nation, and we also are involved with recruitment and people into our industry.
We'll continue here on In the Mix in just a moment.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Once again, here's Marie Osborne.
This week, President Obama visited the Detroit area to talk about community colleges and perhaps careers that don't require a college diploma, at least a four-year university diploma. Joining us this afternoon to talk a little bit about new job opportunities that are out there. Have you ever thought of laying bricks or maybe being an electrician? Lots of different career choices that are maybe off the beaten path. Patrick Devlin's joining us. He's the MUST co-chair. So you're talking about skilled trades offering some good options for young people or maybe people who are looking for a career change. Tell us, I mean, I just named off a couple of them, but I mean, there are a lot of trade jobs out there, and from what I understand, that are going unfilled. So where are you really putting your effort?
Well, we've got all 15 major skilled building trades are looking for applicants, and this isn't new because of the we've always recruited. This is just a new effort, new promotional effort for us to bring an awareness of the opportunities out there for people that want to get into this industry. It's hard work, as you well know, it requires some other things, and that'll be on our website. We definitely have to have some math skills and communication skills, and it's a very rewarding occupation.
And we're talking about carpenters, bricklayers, boilermakers, asbestos abatement workers, cement masons, iron workers, plumbers. All these jobs are looking for millwrights. All of these fields are looking for people. What are we looking at in terms of apprenticeship here, and how much classroom education needs to take place in order to become a millwright, let's say?
Most of our trades work under different standards. They're all dictated by the Federal Bureau of Apprenticeship. So those guidelines are set. Some of our apprenticeships last 2 years. Some go 4 years. The basic training in class is probably you're in class 2 days a month, but most of your training is done hands-on under the supervision of journeymen.
And you get paid while you're in training?
Yeah, that's one of our classic mantras. In this industry, you earn while you learn, and that's a big thing. We always compare getting into one of our apprenticeship programs as equivalent to getting a four-year scholarship to a major university.
But is there an application to the different trades?
Yes, and that can be found on our home base, www.mustcareers.org. And that'll take them to a site that will explain how to apply for all the various building trades.
So you have to qualify in order to get into one of these fields then?
You know, there is a application test that gets in, and there's processes by which an applicant can fill it out right online and submit it. And then there's some trades do have a entry, exam, just to test some skills sets that we're looking for. Some trades are specific to some skill sets that they need. Mostly, I think most of the trades it's referred to the mechanical aptitude test. A pretty simple test. It requires some a knowledge of math skills, communication, spatial relations.
And ultimately, from what the paperwork that I've looked at, you're looking at $28 to $36 an hour. You're looking for good-paying jobs here once you graduate from these programs. And opportunities for women are, how many women do you have in some of these programs?
Definitely. I've always reached out for women. We've, some trades are have more women than others. I don't have a specific numbers, but definitely equal opportunities for all. And a big emphasis also on our returning vets. We definitely have our programs to benefit them on a returning home from conflict. So, but in the Detroit area, with the $5 billion is projected for construction, and that number is probably going to grow just in the Southeast Michigan. And the projects out there, obviously the Illich family put a lot of money in on not only things down the road for corporate headquarters to be announced, but the arena and all the other work that's going to come around there. With that, the multifamily stuff that Mr. Gilbert is involved with, the big three is up and running. So there is definitely going to be a need for more people, and we're going, like all industries are going through, the baby boomers. We've got a lot of people that are probably ready. Well, not probably, they are ready to retire. So,
and so the skilled trade jobs are out there waiting for the taking. Patrick Devlin joining us here on In the Mix. Thank you, Patrick. We hope some people consider that then for the future.
Again, I'd like to emphasize that it can go. We did a launch off to bring a public awareness to it. But again, our website is www.mustcareers.org, and they can get all their questions answered. So thank you very, very much for having me on today.
Thank you, Patrick.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Presented by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health.
Have you been to the West Village? We're talking about the West Village in Detroit. Welcome back here to In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Rochelle has the week off. Now, West Village, where is it? Well, it's an area northeast of downtown Detroit. It's bounded by Kercheval, Jefferson, Parker, and Seaborn. It is an area that if you're not familiar with it, you might want to take a little drive on there through the area someday, some afternoon if you're in the area. Lots of great architecture in this area. And at one time, of course, this was a bustling area of the city of Detroit. And we're seeing a lot of new development in that area. We want to check in with one of the young entrepreneurs who's helped make the resurgence of West Village possible. David Kirby joining us here on In the Mix. And David Kirby is the proprietor of the Parker Street Market. David, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Now, you opened Parker Street Market back in spring of 14, right?
That's right. Yeah, April 3rd. And actually, I think you would probably remember this. You were the first person to ever give me any sort of publicity at all. I met you whenever I was a waiter, and we sort of had a bit of a conversation about what I was working on and my vision. And lo and behold, you were generous enough to sort of cover what I was doing, and it's changed pretty dramatically since then. But we opened April 3rd, and a year and a half in, we've expanded into the space next door, and about a month ago, and things are just going better and better every month.
And we had some pretty serious talks, really, for the original interview that I did with you, because you really were staking a claim in an area that was completely run down and very desolate.
Right.
And so, you know, and now, of course, it's a little different. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the other development in the area. But let's just quickly just take a look back. I mean, at the time that you opened Parker Street Market, it was in an abandoned type building there on Parker Street.
Right.
And, you know, and I pointed out to you, I said, you know, David, you're opening a retail shop, and just down the street, there's a market, but it has bulletproof glass in the store.
Right.
And, you know,
right.
you can't take the shopping cart out of the store. I mean, it was just a totally different vibe. And I said to you, what are you really trying to accomplish here? So take a look back at that and tell me, what was your vision then and how has it changed now?
Well, I wish that I could be the honest answer is I had no idea what I was doing. I just wish that I had been able to plan all this, or at least had the vision for all this. And I think that if I had been able to see where this was heading, I would have been even surprised myself. But, you know, I'm not from Detroit originally, and I feel almost 2 years after living here very much like this is my true home, and I feel very, very thrilled to be here. But, you know, part of my naivete or lack of experience in the city was really has turned into a huge touchstone of what Parker Street Market and the rest of the sort of the villages represent, is just this newfound acceptance to just sort of behave as if this were any other suburban city or anywhere else in the country. I think that, you know, I speak to my customers daily, and they might be wary of maybe that sort of ignorance. But, you know, I tell you what, my wife, my partner, we have just had our first child, but all through her pregnancy worked there. You know, the couple of employees that I have had no incidents whatsoever. And now we're almost a year and a half, a little over a year and a half in, and there's never been an incident. There's just open arms and a welcoming neighborhood, and I've got the best neighbors that do all keep a watchful eye on all of us, and we do the same for them. So it's just become this really beautiful neighborhood, and it's really become this beautiful little coexistence between residents and myself. And now the new businesses that are moving in are all sort of taking note and seeing what we've done and you know, behaving in the same way. So you're seeing bars coming off of the whole strip down Kercheval and down Parker, and really it's all sort of coming back in the same way.
We want to mention that your wife, your partner, is Caitlin James, co-owner of Drought, another young entrepreneur. She has a juice company, and it's an awesome thing as well. When she puts the baby down, maybe another time we'll have an interview with her.
But get the phone in the hand, for sure.
Right, instead of a baby. But David, talk a little bit about, I know that Sister Pie is located now across the street from you, and one of the things that I've noticed about your area in West Village is that the real estate market has really rebounded. I mean, like, boing, it's really rebounded in that area.
It's shocking, I mean, there was a house that went up to market yesterday, and it's sort of making some rather big headlines. The asking price is at about $200,000, and that's huge news for the neighborhood. That's a huge vote of confidence to see. You know, I think about 4 years ago, I've been told by a few realtors that come in to show potential new neighbors that about 4 years ago, there were 80 to 90 abandoned or vacant homes in just the West Village, which really is a very small neighborhood when you look at its footprint. And then last year, the last time that sort of data was taken, there were less than three. And I think that's probably one or of zero abandoned or vacant homes in the neighborhood now. So, you know, the whole neighborhood is booming, and it's so thrilling because people are new people every single day. I look at my sort of daily reports and see new transactions, and almost daily it's still hovering around 50, if not higher, percent of new customers or first time people into the store. So I think that statistic more than anything just shows, you know, the enthusiasm, the excitement, and people are really catching on and seeing, for whatever combination of all sorts of everything, that this is a neighborhood that's really worth
noting and coming to see what's happening.
Now, we want to tell everyone that David is a transplant from New York City, which, you know, a lot of people from this area, young people, go to New York City, specifically Brooklyn, you know, to stake their claim.
Right.
You know, Brooklyn is the epicenter of cool these days, as we all know. But I think they're getting a run for their money here in the Detroit area. And you know, you talked about that. And you, I know you said to me early on, you said, I could never even think about doing something like this in New York.
No, and it's true, and I still couldn't, and I still couldn't fathom even having the right mentality to try and tackle something like that in a city, even like Chicago or New York. But what I'm finding is, and as I'm talking, you know, Sister Pie, Lisa Ludwinski, who's so talented, she was living in New York for a long time. Hugh Yarrow down at Kraftwerk, and Sandy Hasselgrave at Red Hook, all of the business owners in this neighborhood have spent large portions of their life living elsewhere, and for all of us, it's been New York. So I think what we're finding is New York is a really great place to learn and derive a lot of inspiration. But you know, there's just so much opportunity here. It was a no brainer. And Caitlin, my partner as well, she was living in New York and saw the juice boom and wanted to be able to come back home and do something important here. So We all have been able to experience a lot that's elsewhere and maybe sometimes is lacking here, but we understand and recognize the value of a dollar and see that we can sort of stake our own claim in a place that would maybe even appreciate it a bit more than if we even tried to do anything in larger cities like that.
All right, David, as we wrap it up, we want to give you 30 seconds. Here's your time for a commercial. What are your hours and your exact location?
Right. So we're open 6 days a week right now. So we're Tuesday through Sunday. During the week, it's 9 to 7. Saturday is 10 to 6, and Sunday is noon to 5. You know, we are adding new inventory every single day. We've got a brand new expansion, so we've more than doubled our available space for inventory, and we've got everything from Band-Aids to locally made potato chips. So, you know, just come through, and we would love to be able to be your neighborhood corner store, or, you know, to find some new product that you've never tried before, and we've got a little bit of everything. So come by anytime, and we'll be glad to see you come in.
Well, listen, just listening to you, you are living large, my friend, because you have two things that you did not have the last time I talked to you, and that is A, Band-Aids, and B, employees. You are living large.
It's pretty amazing. It's very amazing.
David Kirby, thank you so much for joining us today on In the Mix. Continued success.
Thank you.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health.
And we're back with In the Mix. Rochelle Riley has the week off. Joining us next is Bishop Donald Hanschen, Auxiliary Bishop of Detroit. And talk a little bit about Pope Francis. Bishop, thank you so much for joining us here on the
Thank you, Marie. I'm delighted to be here.
Thrilled to talk with you. Before we talk about the Pope's visit, if we can, let's talk about the big news this week. It was breaking news, in fact, the morning that this happened, that we got word about this. But Pope Francis announcing some new procedures to make it easier for Roman Catholics to obtain marriage annulments. So let's talk a little bit about that. And very quickly, if you could tell me why annulments within the Catholic Church. I know friends of mine who ask me, why is it that the church requires an annulment? It's hard even for me to explain it. So why don't you give us an idea of what an annulment is and why?
Sure. Well, I remember in my many years as a parish priest, Marie, I used to always say to couples who approached me about this that the church has a pro-marriage bias, and that's specifically because of what Jesus says in the gospel, that when a man and a woman come together in marriage, that it's meant to be, you know, forever. And he's asked the question, is it okay to divorce for any reason? That's the question that he's addressed. And he says, my response is, in the beginning, God joined man and woman together, and they're supposed to stay that way. And so he, instead of allowing conditions for divorce to be permitted, he says, "Let me just tell you what marriage is supposed to be." And having said that quite clearly in the gospel, the church confronted with the reality of today, where so many people attempt a marriage. They think it's, I don't think anybody gets married willing to break it up, thinking this might not work. They always think it's going to work out. But in fact, for X, Y, or Z reasons, it doesn't. And so they come to the church and say, you know, I want to be able to receive Holy Communion, because someone who's divorced, they're not cast out of the church, but they're not able to receive Holy Communion until they submit their marriage for a judgment by the church. And that's what the process of nullity means. It means that upon examination, the church determines that even though both parties at the time of the marriage were willing and thought they knew what they were doing, that there was something missing, something so essentially missing from the relationship that despite their best intentions, it was not what the church calls a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a process that the Holy Father, with just by his decree, vastly simplified. And the main lines of the simplification are, instead of having the judgment in the local marriage tribunal or court, if it's rendered a positive, yes, this marriage may be annulled, then it has to go to a court of second instance. It needed a second judgment to approve that. The Holy Father says one judgment should be enough.
Mm-hmm.
And he also declared that there should not be a cost involved.
Right.
So there's got to be some way found to address the administrative costs, but the people asking for the annulment should not have to pay a huge fee for it. As a matter of fact, in my years as a priest, going back to Cardinal Schocke, so going way back to the early 1980s, that's been the case in Detroit. There has been no charge for an annulment. It was
really?
The process. Yeah, that's right. So, and it was always covered by the CSA. So every year when the CSA comes around in May, it's always mentioned that one of the things that the CSA, Catholic Services Appeal, covers is the cost of running our marriage court or tribunal. So a divorce means we were legally married and now we're legally separated. The church says once you're legally married, if you entered that marriage freely, you're still married until it's proved that something was missing. You were not totally free, or you weren't mature enough to understand the obligations. One of the classic reasons for an annulment is that one or both parties didn't refuse to have children.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of reasons why an annulment
right.
might be granted, but the annulment is to say that what looked like a marriage was in fact not a marriage, and so both parties are freed from that relationship. So,
I was just going to say, so this is fast tracking the cases so that they can be heard in as fast as 30 days, I understand, or most within 45 days.
Yeah, well, it can be heard, but you got to keep in mind that there's a big backlog of cases,
right,
and so
right.
What I think it's more realistic to assume that it shouldn't take any longer than a year from
right.
the time you submit the case to a judgment being rendered. In many cases, it's far less than that. In the press conference in Rome last week, they talked about the conditions. If both parties agree that the marriage has failed and there's no contest, and the reasons can be quite amply and simply demonstrated as to what was missing, it could be rather quick,
right.
within a matter of months instead
right.
of a year.
So, Bishop Hanchin, we are talking to Bishop Donald Hanchin, the Auxiliary Bishop of Detroit, talking a little bit about Pope Francis and also some of the news that he has made recently. I think the bigger picture here, though, Bishop, and I think you would absolutely agree, is this effort by this Pope to bring everyone into full communion with the Church and to bring to open the doors of
That's
the
right.
churches, to welcome all in instead of some exclusionary things that perhaps people had felt
That's
in
right.
the past.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. As a bishop, what are your thoughts and feelings about that?
Well, I think it's very interesting that the Pope's this marriage nullity simplification was sort of kept secret until the very last moment, and it's been settled before this big world meeting of bishops in Rome in October on families. It's as if the Pope wanted to say, I don't want annulments to be something that you're worried about. Here's what we're going to do about annulments.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to
mm-hmm.
make them open to all. We're going to make them not expensive. We're going to make them as rapid as possible so that you know that the arms of the Church are extended to you. Don't feel you're cut off.
Now,
that's a great thing, and he's a person of such great human skills. He's always smiling.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And if he's not smiling, you think, gee, what's wrong? He just knows how to reach out to people, to touch them, to embrace them. I'm so impressed. Last week he did this virtual visit to the U.S. to places that he could not go in Los Angeles and McAllen, Texas, and Chicago, and addressed several people in each of those groups. And I was even surprised that the young high school girl in Chicago, he spoke to her in English, and he said, "Would you sing a song for me?" And then when she looked nervous, he says, "Be brave, do it, you can do it." It was great.
Great people skills, and we might add, he doesn't have a PR person, so this is it seems pretty genuine.
Yeah, it's unadulterated.
Yeah,
that's
pretty genuine. Now, he's set to arrive September 22nd here in the U.S. Now, he'll be in Cuba before he arrives, but you and I had talked earlier about this incredible schedule that he's going to keep. So he has to go to Cuba. Then he will arrive in New York. He's going to be addressing a joint session of Congress. He will also be at the United Nations General Assembly. He will be going to Philadelphia. The crowds and masses of people that
it's going to be incredible.
Yeah, that he's going to touch is going to be incredible.
Yeah, actually, he starts his journey in Washington. He's going to land in Washington and be in Washington and meet the all the bishops of the country. I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, so you'll get a chance to meet him then?
Yeah, well, yes, I'll be in a room with him, but I don't think there's going to be a chance for every one of the bishops to go up and shake his hand. But be that as it may, he's going to address
what
us all at the cathedral, and then in the morning, and then later that afternoon, this would be on. Let's see, get my schedule right. It'll be on Wednesday. And then in the afternoon, there will be a mass at the Basilica that canonizes Father Junipero Serra, priest, Franciscan priest from California, who founded a lot of the California missions. And then from there, the next day, he goes to, in the morning, he speaks to Congress, joint session of Congress, and then he takes off for New York and visits the UN and does all the things that Cardinal Dolan's going to have him do.
Right.
I think Friday evening he finally gets to Philadelphia, and he'll be at Philadelphia Saturday and Sunday with the World Congress of Families. So it is an incredible tour de force. I think it's been stated that in most cases he will speak in Spanish and have a translator. So that'll be a great thing for all the Hispanics in the U.S.
Exactly. And that is really, you've spent a lot of your time, of course, with that community. So that'll be a great thing for you to witness as well.
Yeah. Sure. Oh, it sure will. It sure will. Yeah.
Well, we're very much looking forward to this visit. He's going to make a lot of news. As a news person, I know he'll be making a lot of news. And I know as in your line of work, I'm sure you're hoping he'll bring some spirituality, badly needed spirituality, perhaps, to some corners of this country.
Absolutely. He's so open to people that my experience, Mary, has been from people who are not Catholic who say to me, you know, I'm not Catholic, but I just really love your Pope. And so I think he will make a lot of news, but I think that people who are sort of not Christians even, or of another religion or of no religion, he's going to touch them in some way. And I'm sure that's his hope as well, to just get them to understand that the Church cares about them, that we want to be a brother, a sister, a friend. And I think that's just great news for U.S. Catholics, but it's good news for United States citizens.
Bishop Donald Hanschen, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us
Thank
here
you,
on
Marie.
In the Mix. Rochelle is going to be so bummed that she wasn't here to talk with you.
Well, call me again when she's there.
I am, and we will have you back on. I hope you have a wonderful visit in Washington with the
Thank
Pope.
You.
And I hope you do shake his hand. That would
Thank
be
you.
Such
I,
a thrill
if I can,
for you.
I'm going to tell him how much Detroiters love him.
I was just going to say, make sure you give him a great message from the Motor City, okay?
You bet.
Thanks, Bishop.
Thank you, Marie. God bless.
She's back. Hard to believe. 3 decades ago, Vanessa Williams had to give up her Miss America crown due to a scandal involving some nude photos. You talk about the biggest story of the day. That was it back in 1984. Joining us today on In the Mix, Dr. Hillary Levy-Friedman. She's a local hometown girl, but she's joining us. She's a sociologist, author of the book, review editor, and teacher at Brown University in the Development of American Studies. Hillary, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So you teach a class at Brown on pageants, beauty pageants in American society. We thought it would be a good fit to have you come in to talk on the broader topic of beauty pageants, not just about Vanessa Williams tonight being on the Miss America pageant. But before we get into the, you know, your class and some of your thoughts on all this, just give me your first thought about Vanessa Williams coming back. Quite a bit of redemption here.
It is a bit of redemption, and it's also some really good PR for the Miss America pageant. It's put them back in the mix in the wake of Donald Trump and all of his Miss USA brouhaha over the summer, and so it's getting some sort of positive. negative attention for the Miss America program.
That's, yeah, we thought the same thing as well, that, you know, it was clearly a great PR stroke, that's for sure. But let's talk a little bit on the broader topic of pageants. I know this is your area of specialty, and we should also say your mom was a former Miss America from Michigan.
That's correct. She was Miss Michigan and then Miss America in 1970, Pam Eldred.
And a beautiful woman who unfortunately couldn't join us today because we were hoping she could come on, but maybe we'll make that happen at another time. But Hillary, talk to us a little bit about are pageants still relative in society for young women today? I mean, I know when I was growing up, you know, 100 million years ago, that, yeah, everybody watched the pageant. All of us girls would watch the pageant and we'd have comments and it was important to us, but a little different these days.
Certainly women today have so many different choices. Basically, there aren't any avenues closed to women these days. You know, there was just the first female Army Ranger that passed the course. And so, you know, in the olden days, you might say, the Miss America pageant was a path to respectability, to educational opportunities, to professional opportunities, particularly in the entertainment world, that it's not quite as good at today, but it's still a valid choice. Like, if you believe feminism is about choice, then this is a valid choice. Now, we also have to talk about the role of beauty in our society, not just in American society, but around the world. And with about 40 brown undergraduates yesterday, we had a conversation about the fact that beauty matters, and there's robust findings across the social sciences and the sciences, biology, neuroscience, psychology, economics, showing us that it matters how you look. And so I think what a lot of people find uncomfortable about beauty pageants is that they sort of lay bare the fact that, yes, unfortunately, it matters how you look. And, yes, some people can work harder to look better. Some people were blessed with genetic endowments that made them more attractive. They sort of won the genetic lottery. But you could say the same thing for the big guys that play, you know, on the defensive line for the Lions, that if they weren't born big, they would not be able to make millions of dollars. And so, you know, beauty pageants sort of capture a lot of what's going on in society and represent a lot of that. And that's kind of exactly what happened with Vanessa Williams. You know, you have in the Vanessa Williams story, race, gender, sexuality,
yeah,
all of these themes that we still struggle with, but that were captured in 1984 and are still making a mark today.
And just this past week, Donald Trump's interview came out in Rolling Stone, as you talk about appearances, and he commented on Carly Fiorina's appearance. Now, here's a woman who is extremely accomplished in business. She's making a real inroad and a real run for the Republican nomination for president. And he says in this article, and I'm paraphrasing, I wish I had it in front of me. So he paraphrased something like, would you want to have a president who looked like that? Or why would you vote for someone who looked like that? And so, again, the appearances, the issue of appearance, even for a woman running for president.
Well, this is true for men running for president, too. So in this case, Donald Trump is not wrong that there have been several studies that look at how important appearance and look is in politics. And in fact, one of the books I just taught is by an economist whose name is Daniel Hammermesh, and he teaches at the University of Texas, Austin, and he wrote this book called Beauty Pays, Why Attractive People Are More Successful, and there's a huge section on politicians and politicians' height, how they look, how they're evaluated, and as more and more women enter politics, this becomes a bigger issue, but it equally applies to the men as well. And interestingly enough, a lot of my research is looking at the link between pageants and politics, and we had to look to two election cycles ago to see Sarah Palin had competed in the Miss Alaska pageant. And so there's an argument we can make that a lot of skills and experiences that beauty queens have in terms of being in parades, attending lots of civic functions, chicken dinners, all of that, that these skills are quite transferable to the political arena today, which says a lot about how our political system works.
We are talking to Dr. Hillary Levy Friedman. She grew up here in the Detroit area. She currently lives on the East Coast. She's an author, of course, and I think working on your second book, Hillary, we'll want to know about that in just a second, but your first book, Playing to Win, Raising Children in a Competitive Culture, Following the Path of Elementary School Kids Involved in Competitive Dance, Youth Travel, Soccer, and Scholastic Chess. And so you're really an expert in this area of competition and really beauty and competition, teaching the class at Brown beauty pageants in American society. Do you watch the pageants, Hillary?
Absolutely. It's it's work for me, so it's kind of mixing work and fun at times, although there were definitely some episodes of Toddlers and Tiara that I did not find entertaining.
Oh, so you even watch those shows then?
Yeah, so the course I teach and the book I'm working on is not just about the sort of adult pageants, Miss America, Miss USA, Miss Universe, all of those, but also the kid pageants and sort of the whole world of this organized competition around beauty. There's even a week on, you know, dance and cheerleading and bodybuilding, so I call it Beauty Pageants by Another Name.
But why are we so enamored in America with competition and pageants and my kid being the best and getting the trophy?
Well, you know, how much time do you have?
So give me an answer in 60, 90 seconds, okay?
Well, in more contemporary times, we could think about the way our higher education system in the U.S. has developed and worked, which is quite different than it is in other countries. And so being able to distinguish yourself in different realms and unique realms makes you a more attractive candidate to a lot of colleges and universities. And so a lot of kids start this process much earlier. But also, the United States was founded on this Protestant ethic, ethos of work. And, you know, competition becomes a way to quantify that, and working toward a goal is a big part of the American identity.
Now, Hillary, tell us about the book that you plan to work on. I know that one is directly related to beauty pageants.
Yeah, so again, it's about the role of beauty pageants in American society, the links between child pageants and adult pageants, if we think there are any. I started studying child beauty pageants actually about 15 years ago, and I attended 19 of them, interviewed about 40 moms with daughters who were 6 and under competing, and so now I'm going to be going back, finding them, finding out what happened to them, because that's one of the big questions we talk about, what happens to the girls. And then, of course, looking also, linked to that, what happens to the women who compete in Miss America and Miss USA, also other programs like America's Junior Miss, which is now called Distinguished Young Women of America. Diane Sawyer famously won America's Junior Miss in the 1960s. But, you know, what happens long term? I'm collecting a lot of data about competitors at both the national level and the state level, looking at sort of can we predict the winners who ended up winning each year, and are women going on to do what they say they're going to do in their bios, and when they won. And then, of course, as you mentioned, a little bit part of the story as well is linking this to my family's history with pageants.
Absolutely. Dr. Hillary Levy-Friedman, thank you so much for joining us here on In the Mix today. This won't be our last conversation. I know we'll talk again. It's always a pleasure. So informative. And I know tonight when they sing Here She Comes, Miss America, your chair is going to be right in front of that television set.
Actually, I'm there tonight.
Oh, awesome. I didn't know. You're going to be in the audience.
Yes.
Oh, that's going to be
here
fantastic.
Here in Atlantic City. 95 years of Miss America, the longest running cultural event on US TV.
Hillary, good luck. Have a great time, and we'll talk again.
Thank you.
I don't think we'll ever watch Miss America through the same eyes or with the same eyes ever again. Thanks, Dr. Friedman, for the insight into the Miss America pageants and competition in general in our society. Our thanks this week in the mix, helping to bring it to fruition, producer Laura Hessen, production director Rich Luzinski. We want to thank you for joining us, and of course Rochelle Riley will be back with us next week. Thanks for joining us. Keep in touch on inthemix@gmail.com.